This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Back from a week off. Welcome to this week's Terry's Talking Podcast. I'm David Campbell, your host, and I am joined, as I am every week, by Mr. Terry Pluto, award-winning columnist from The Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com. How you doing, Terry?
I am doing well, David.
I know you were off last week. I'm glad we're able to get back at it Thanksgiving week. And I think what people should do is put on Terry's Talking at Thanksgiving dinner and have everybody kind of listen to it together, right? And then they can talk about it.
Well, it depends on the families. And some of them, it might not be a bad idea if we're going to argue about stuff from 50 years ago. And at others, it's like, that might start an argument.
You never know. So, hey, Terry, while we got a second, speaking of things that people might want to talk about over Thanksgiving, let's talk about your book real quick while we have a second. The Guy with the Sign is a collection of your Faith in You columns that you've written the last couple of years. It's The Guy with the Sign and Other Thoughts on Faith in Everyday Life. And it's holiday season. It makes a great stocking stuffer. Why don't you talk about it real quick, and we'll give it a quick plug, and then we'll move on.
Yeah, if you like my faith writing, everything is in there. From, for example, the guy with the sign is, what do you do about the guy with the sign who wants money? That was one of the most read faith columns that I did, and there are a lot of different thoughts on it, which way to go. Another one in there is, should you call a dying friend? And that's a column that I did with Rocky Calavito when we talked about how Rocky stayed in touch with Herb Score over the last years of his life, especially after Herb had lost his ability to speak due to a stroke. And that, believe me, that isn't easy on the phone to do that. So those are a couple things. You can get signed copies at terrypluto.com, all one word together, terrypluto.com. And starting after Thanksgiving, starting next week, I'm going to be doing some signings around town. And also,
great.
There's a sample chapter up on cleveland.com right now, and there'll be another sample chapter up tomorrow. And that is about, you'll like this, if you remember the old Red Barn restaurant, this will be a stories for you. So I'm just thrilled that after, I've been writing this thing now for 23 years, going back to the Beacon Journal, and also how it's gained a lot of both readers and traction, I would say, the last, really since the pandemic hit in 2020. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, and it's perfect for this time of year, too. Just that you write a lot about being thankful and grateful, and it's a spiritual nugget every week. So if you want to catch the excerpts, you can go to cleveland.com/Pluto, and they'll be there. So, all right, Terry, we've got a lot to get through here. We're going to talk to some Browns. We can get into the Guardians. I don't think we talked. Our last podcast was before the Stephen Vogt press conference, two or three days mm-hmm. before, so we can get into that a little bit. The Cavs have some interesting games coming up, including one Saturday against LeBron and the Lakers. And then, Terry, for our 100th episode a while ago, we asked people to write in where they're from and why they're Cleveland fans. And we've had responses from Charleston, South Carolina, Kenya, the UK. And we have one today from Slovenia. So I thought that was really interesting. So it'll be fun to get into. So let's start with the Browns, the 7-3 Browns, Terry. And you wrote this right after the game. It's crazy to think that this team is 7-3 after everything that's gone on.
it's a tribute not just to Stefanski, but the coaching staff overall. You know, Bubba Ventrone has, I think, made the special teams better. Of course, it helps when you have a veteran kicker. And this was a move made by Andrew Berry right before the season began to go get Dustin Hopkins. And then also to, Cade York, his draft pick, to say, okay, you know, we can't wait on you, Cade. We got to go get a quality veteran. And remember a couple years ago, he went out and got Bohorquez, the punter, and he's big time. Some of the rating systems have the Browns special teams like in the top three. Fans sometimes too focused too much on, they're not getting big returns for a lot of yardage as opposed to looking at the whole unit. How does it defend? Does it stay out of penalties? You know, what's the kicking game like? And so that's been a big deal. The defense, of course, is elite. And also, you know, the front office spent time working with Stefanski to upgrade the coordinators. And Stefanski allows those guys to do their job. And clearly, they're doing it. And that's what I think a big deal there, because so much oftentimes when a head coach just calls plays, the whole focus is on play calling and nothing else that he does.
Yeah, so Terry, I was interested in looking at what Kevin Stefanski has done this year. And I keep thinking of what he says after every game, which is like, and he's using this on purpose, I think. He says, we're not perfect, but we're fighting like crazy. And I think that is what his team does, but I also think it's what he's doing. You know what I mean? Like, I think he knows they should have challenged the Myles Garrett sack when the ball was right on the goal line. That if that was reviewed, he couldn't get the flag out, or the officials didn't give him the review in time for the next play. Like, they could have had a safety there, but then like the rest of the game, the way he pieced everything together was really impressive. I thought, I mean, they're rotating offensive tackles.
Yeah, they are.
It's like we're watching a high school game in 1988 or something, you know? It's like, what is that?
And that when we're talking about the coaching staff with Ventrone and with Schwartz, then you go into Bill Callahan, who is patching up that offensive line. And Stefanski often gives Callahan credit for different running plays. He says that he's one of the great play callers, or at least drawing them up for the running backs. And so that's another thing, too, that working with your staff, and it does seem like that they don't have a lot of it. Remember the dreaded internal discord line that the Browns threw out when they got rid of Hugh Jackson and changed the coaching staff around? They don't seem to have much of that on their coaching staff, those problems. So,
yeah, it was interesting, Terry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Jimmy Watkins, our colleague, went to the Steelers locker room the other day, and the Steelers, the players were grumbling about the offensive play calling, the way they're not producing. And Mike Tomlin was like, yeah, we're fine, don't worry about it. And then today they fired Matt Canada, their offensive coordinator, like 2 days after they're losing. This is like, it's like the world is upside down for Browns fans. Like, usually it's the Browns locker room that's having all kinds of drama, and the Steelers are the ones that are having stability. So you're right. It was really weird the other day.
It's also, you know, you sometimes have to basically make a move like they did with Canada. I remember when David Griffin fired David Blatt at the All-Star break, and the Cavs were in first place. And I was talking to Griffin later, and he said, sometimes you have to take the excuse away from the players. He said, I didn't really think that we needed to make that big of a coaching change, but the players basically gave Blatt credit for nothing and blamed him for anything that went wrong. Well, it seems like the offense there, it was always Matt Canada's fault. I mean, he didn't seem to be very good from my distant looking at it. So, okay, you're tired of that. Now it's on you. And that's probably a discussion maybe the front office and ownership had with Tomlin. It's like, look, we've just been hearing this stuff over and over and over with Canada, and the stats bear out the fact we're not scoring any points. So let's try somebody else.
Yeah, and there's still time to salvage the season. But Terry, I wanted to ask you, I think Stefanski has got to be one of the most underappreciated coaches in the NFL this season. I was looking to see who the odds on favorites are for Coach of the Year. I couldn't believe this. Like Dan Campbell of the Lions, he's number one on the list. He's plus 150. And then it goes D'Amico Ryans, Mike mm-hmm. McDaniel of the Dolphins, Kevin O'Connell of the Vikings, Mike Tomlin of the Steelers at 6-4 is ahead of Kevin Stefanski. Nick Sirianni at 9-1 is ahead of Kevin Stefanski. Robert Saleh of the Jets at 4-6. Pete Carroll, Doug Peterson, and Kyle Shanahan, all those guys have better odds to win the NFL Coach of the Year than Kevin Stefanski. And if you look, man, like he hasn't had Deshaun Watson for 2/3 of the season. Nick Chubb goes out in week 2. Juan Thornhill didn't play Sunday. His two starting offensive tackles are out, and he was shuffling in offensive tackles, and TJ Watt didn't have much of an impact on the game the other day. Like that doesn't happen by accident. I just think he's not getting enough due here, and he should be much higher on this list. Maybe if the Browns start getting close to 10 or 11 wins, we'll see that. But I just couldn't believe all these guys were getting more respect in terms of the Coach of the Year race. Well, are you surprised by that or not?
Not particularly in his why. One is Kevin doesn't help himself in his press conferences or anything. You know, you listen to that. Like you said, even when he tries to compliment somebody, then he throws in, we're not perfect. Or it's just, he is painful to listen to. And not particularly interesting. And
on purpose.
But, yeah. David, the good ones, you know, I will say, like, Terry Francona's press conferences are interesting. As I said to, I remember at one time talking to Eric Wedge about this, and it's because even the tribe people back then, they were trying to get him to loosen up or whatever. And I said, it's not about being controversial, it's saying some obvious things in interesting and different ways. You know, don't just say, oh, like Victor Martinez is a good hitter. You can say stuff like, you know, the guy's a catcher. He's getting beat up all day behind the plate, and he goes out there and gets 2 hits. That's harder than people think. You know, that kind of stuff. And Stefanski has zero interest in doing that. I mean, basically, he reminds me of a guy, he just wants to get out of each press conference alive. I don't want you can't pin anything on me. And I remember early on in his first year, I wrote, he's kind of like a nice Belichick, you know, that there. If you were to read just the transcripts, they weren't going to be a whole lot different. So that doesn't help him. And I think there's still a lot of backlash around the NFL and that people bought the Watson deal. You know, that is held against the Browns. And, of course, that is one of the reasons that you make a case for Kevin as a Coach of the Year candidate is because Watson, what has he really done? You know, Watson had a great game against Baltimore. That's the one game that he clearly swung in their direction, and I don't know if any other quarterbacks could have won that. But, you know, when you look at their scores and you turn around, I mean, they held the Bengals to 3 points. They won 24-3. They beat Tennessee 27-3. With P.J. Walker, they beat the 49ers 19-7. With Walker, they beat the Colts 39-38. Arizona 27-0. I mean, anybody could have sort of played quarterback that day. So really, the one big game he's had, it was Baltimore. And it was huge. It really was. I think that it's a positive, but there's a lot of backlash about that. And also, you would think that with Watson being out at right after that Baltimore game, that there would have been some sort of letdown, and there wasn't.
All right, Terry. So we were talking about Watson being out, and we haven't really talked about Dorian Thompson-Robinson very much. His second NFL start, the first one he found out about a couple hours before the game. So this was, you could probably say this was his first real NFL start. In the regular season, 24 of 43, 55.8%, 165 yards passing, 54.9 rating. What did you think of what you saw from DTR? What did you think of what you saw from DTR on Sunday? And I don't know, give us a quick summary.
The first half I thought was pretty solid. I think they put up 10 points, and he looked pretty comfortable with the offense. Then remember in the second half, because I was sitting by you, and heading into that last drive, they had a grand total of 28 yards passing in the second half. And so I'm thinking, well, they certainly figured something out, and they've not been able to adjust to it. And then he made several big throws on that drive. I looked at it. There were short to medium throws, but they were quick and on time. And they got down the field and they kicked the field goal. So I think that was great for him. And by the way, the first DTR game, I would say that's Kevin Stefanski's low point of the season. Because remember, it's like, well, we didn't have the second game plan ready to go, all that kind of stuff. Well, you should always have, in my mind, kind of two game plans ready. One for your starter and at least bare bones of something else if you have to go to the bench. Because you never know when a quarterback's going to get hurt. So you were correct. This is his first chance. I mean, and the guy, by the way, he's faced Baltimore. He's faced Pittsburgh. That's it.
Yeah, and it's something to, you think of quarterbacks as being these steely-eyed, you know, nothing rattles them kind of guys. And after DTR threw that interception, like he was visibly shaken on the sideline. And Deshaun Watson had to kind of help him get his head up and say, like, listen, it's not over. We're going to need you. And I thought that was interesting, the way that Deshaun picked him up and then he went out and played. And the other thing, Terry, about DTR that I thought was, if you add in, I think the Browns had six drops during that game. And if you add those in, then he's 30 of 43, probably for over 200 yards. And they'll get some of that cleaned up. There were guys dropping passes that usually don't drop them, especially David Njoku. So that'll be different, I think, at Denver this Sunday.
Njoku should vote for DTR as his all-time favorite quarterback because he threw to him 15 times. 15!
Yeah, and Njoku said after the game he was going home and getting on the jugs gun so it doesn't happen again.
And also, and he did. Because Stefanski mentioned that he sent him some copies of FaceTime or something of him at home with his judge gun catching passes.
Yep.
Elijah Moore shows some life in with that. Now I'm getting things in the mail, email, and what about this, saying, well, you know, yeah, they won, but the Browns have no receivers. Well, okay, they got Cooper, but they have nobody else. They're not getting any production from them. Your thoughts?
Oh, I thought you were going to say what your thoughts were first. Well, we've talked about this, Terry. David Njoku is your second receiver. He's your number two receiver. And I think that Stefanski keeps saying, we're going to need everybody in this locker room. We're going to need everybody. Like Cedric Tillman, I don't know how much he's been targeted this season, but it has not been hardly at all.
No.
You can count it on one hand, I think. And these other guys are going to have to start producing. Because Cooper's going to be bracketed, and they're going to have to find other guys that are in single coverage or sitting down in a zone somewhere, because it can't go on like this forever. And I think there is some truth to that. Those emails that's got to happen. There's got to be more production from more guys.
Correct. But also, I just say the idea is to win the game, and if that's what it takes, you know, that the tight end and Moore, along with Cooper, then you just do it. Because there's something weird about the offense because Tillman moved into the DPJ role, and they weren't throwing to him either. So,
that's true.
And the year before, he was catching the ball. I think DPJ is a decent receiver, but I don't know whether that is a guy that's just running down the field to clear out safeties or something. I don't get it. But so we're going to see. But my point is, Stefanski's doing better with that idea of what does it take to win this game. You know, I'm not going to sit around I don't want to hear analytics on everything or whatever. How do I win games? And you could roll back to how he was so successful in Minnesota the one year when they opened with Teddy Bridgewater, or thought they were, and he got hurt in training camp. Then they went to Sam Bradford, and I believe he got hurt in the third game of the season. And then he rolled into Case Keenum and won 11-3 with Keenum starting, and they made the playoffs. He kept adapting. Now, he was the quarterback coach then and had, I think, quite a bit of input also into the play calling. So he showed that, and just like with Brissett, I thought last year, oh, yeah, but he was only 4-7 or whatever. They were 10th in scoring with Jacoby Brissett. And if you had thrown this defense in with Jacoby Brissett, you could take that 4-7 and at least flip it around. Because, you know, that was the time of blowing coverages and those things that were just so annoying. In fact, it was funny. I saw they showed some tapes of Flacco's game with the Jets against Cleveland, you know, last year. And there's these guys just wide open, 20 yards behind everybody else in the defense. And we rarely seen that. which just shows you, you know, playing more of this man-to-man stuff when you have guys, at least they know what they're supposed to be doing, even if they get beat.
The assignment soundness and the tackling, it has been night and day from last year to this year. I don't think anybody could deny that. So I just want to wrap up DTR real quick, Terry. So it's crazy to think he went from not playing to starting to at the end of the game that fans were chanting DTR, DTR. Yeah. And what do you want to see from him against the Broncos on Sunday?
Just a little bit more of maybe throwing downfield and that, because I don't blame Kevin for having those quick throws. I saw there was a thing on the television set where in the press box, I looked up middle of the third quarter, he was getting rid of the ball in 2.1 seconds. That is fast. And it was intentional to keep Watt from wrecking the game and some of these others. So now, in fact, I mentioned to you a couple times, I thought they could throw longer if you rolled him out down towards the sideline and let it rip that way. Because he could certainly throw off the move. So that would be something there. You know, Denver's good all of a sudden. Denver's won, I think, 4 in a row. Russell Wilson's found itself. So that's going to be, by the way, his first road game as a quarterback. And Denver is loud. So let's see how that goes. It's a hard place to win.
Yep.
But I remember I thought it would be a big problem for the Browns when Walker went into Seattle, which is very loud. And I think they only had one false start in that game.
Yeah, and speaking of that, Terry, man, the Browns had one penalty for 10 yards the other day. I can't remember last time I saw that from a Browns team, which was something else against the defense they were going against. So, all right, so we got to move along here, but we do need to do the Terry Pluto weekly kicker update.
Mm-hmm.
Dustin Hopkins, season stats, I'll just rattle them off real quick. 26 of 29, he has a long of 58 yards. 15 of 16 on extra points and 7 of 7 from 50 yards or longer. Those are the numbers, Terry. Where are you at with Dustin Hopkins?
Well, they are 4-0 in games decided by 3 points or fewer. And without Dustin Hopkins, they probably, with just say a normal kicker, you might be 1-3. Simple as that.
Yeah, that's true. If you do the math, that's pretty accurate.
Yeah. You have to assume the other kicker would have made one of those clutch field goals in there at some point, but I doubt he would kick. This has been very reminiscent of some of the best of Phil Dawson. And by the way, like Dawson, Hopkins is kicking better from longer in his 30s than he did in his 20s. And that's when Phil began to gain more distance in that. And he said it just came with experience on how to handle things. So that's huge. And Bajorquez is very good punting too. He had one that he shanked, but overall, I have a tremendous amount of confidence. And I remember how when Cade York was struggling, there was this whole school of thought that, Bajorquez was a bad holder, and earlier in his career that was the problem. And I remember texting somebody with the Browns way high up, and he just simply wrote back to me. He said, "Look, we love Cade York, but it's not the holder's fault." And I think we see that since Hopkins is having the best year of his career with Bajorquez.
Yep. Yep. All right, Terry, we will wrap up the Browns here in a second. I wanted to share this stat that I came across on the X machine, formerly known as Twitter. It's a guy named Ben B. Baldwin. His handle is Computer Cowboy, but he sent this out. It's an amazing chart. Through 11 weeks, the Browns defense has been the hardest ever since 1999 to earn a first down.
Jeez.
So I guess the average conversion rate in 2023 is 70%, where a team converts a series into a first down and keeps going. The Browns have allowed 56%. So that's 14% below what the average series conversion rate is. And we're talking about, like, that's better than the 2019 Patriots, who are number two on this list. The 2005 Chicago Bears, who were at 12.3% lower than average. The 2002 Buccaneers. The 2019 San Francisco 49ers. The 2006 Bears. Like, since they've been keeping this since 1999, the Browns have the best conversion rate or lack of conversion rate for opposing offenses. They're allowing 50. I couldn't believe that. That's so impressive since 1999.
And then you look
we'll
at
see
the,
if they can keep that up. But
their third, how they are on third down, getting off the field all the time too. It's elite. It is a combination of the front office bringing in the type of players that Schwartz likes, and then Schwartz putting them to work. And it's a combination, too, of the front office saying analytics is something, but it's not everything. They got heavier on that defense. So Shelby Harris, Maurice Hurst, you know, along with Tomlinson in the middle of that line, I think Harris had two tip passes on Kenny Pickett. So they did some really good bargain shopping with those two guys, with Hurst and with Harris, and along with spending money, Ogbo and Tomlinson. And then you look at the secondary. Now, this is getting a little bit serious now. McLeod's out and Thornhill. I don't like – now, he's back having this the infamous calf muscle again. So that's something to be concerned on with the safety. So, but overall, and, you know, the Schwartz mantra of, you know, how they're going to play and the wide nine and all this. By the way, do you notice Myles Garrett no longer drops these kind of passive aggressive weird things about play calling the coordinators anymore? Because I do think that Schwartz sat him down and said, you know, this is how we do it. And Myles, I've got, and he could probably, he has his chart on all the great defensive ends he's had. You could be as good as any of them, maybe better. And just stick with this, you know. And Myles has done that. And Myles, every member, he's still growing up, I mean, as a player.
And one of the voices of this team now, and you're right, you're seeing him smiling a lot more. I don't think it's because of the winning. I think because it's fun to come to work every day.
Yeah.
And they're having a good time.
And I think with Myles, you have to, whether it's fair or not, earn his respect. And he has to decide that you're going to help make him be a better player. And, you know, Schwartz came in with that reputation for linemen. And so that helped to begin with. He had that. Whereas, you know, some of the other guys he's played for, defensive coordinators, I think it's like, well, this guy didn't know anything. What did he ever do? And that matter, you know, Myles has been, like, he was, I believe, the number one or number two recruit in the entire country coming out of high school when he went to Texas A&M. Then he's the top pick in the draft. So he's had these exalted positions in his entire life. And then when he was here and the teams were bad early, it was like, well, you know, he's the one shining light and everything. So now he's part of a whole defense. And I like how Schwartz talks about, you know, it's not just you getting your sacks. It's, you know, team sacks and how things matter. How
Za'Darius Smith.
Za'Darius Smith doesn't. Boy, I was going to flip into Darius Garland, but just that.
That's the next segment.
Yeah, yeah. He doesn't have that many sacks, whatever. But I believe he's second on the team in quarterback hits, and so these guys are setting it up together. And he, you know, Schwartz's point always is, how is the unit playing? And the unit is playing great.
All right. Well, the Browns are at Denver on Sunday, and then they're not coming home after the Denver game. They're actually heading out to L.A. and are going to practice out there and stay out there and play the Rams the following Sunday. So they'll be breaking from the routine a little bit. It's going to be an interesting two-game swing. Let's take a break, Terry. When we come back, we're going to get into the Cavs a little bit. Let's talk about Darius Garland when we get back. I want to see what you think about his turnover problem and what you would do if you were a coach to kind of help him solve this. So we'll be right back. Terry's talking.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're back on Terry's Talk and David Campbell and Terry Pluto. Terry, before I forget, as I often do, I want to mention your newsletter. If you want to sign up for Terry's newsletter, you can get everything he writes once a week in your email box every Monday. Go to cleveland.com/newsletters and just click on the box with Terry's newsletter and put your email in. It takes like a minute and you can get everything he writes. So it's a great way to keep up with what Terry has been doing. So, all right, Terry, the Cavs are 7-6 and they've won 3 in a row. Pretty impressive win over the Nuggets the other night. And we're kind of looking at a team that has not really been whole the whole season, and different guys are moving in and out of the lineup. But one thing that's a little concerning, even during this winning streak, Darius Garland is really playing well offensively, but he's averaging 4.8 turnovers a game. And he's averaging 5.8 assists, but the 4.8 turnovers is really high. It got me thinking about all the coaches you've known for the Cavs over the years, and what do you do when your star player is turning the ball over so much in terms of talking with him or restricting his minutes a little bit? Or what do you do, and are you worried at all about this Darius Garland turnover issue that's been popping up?
I am, because the 5.8 assist is not that high in the contract. Now, I remember some guys, it was more in the olden days, so they were averaging almost 9 or 10 assists and 4 turnovers. So they had the ball a lot. They were creating a lot of baskets for their teammates and sometimes some turnovers. You know, you could get with, in this age of all the technological stuff, you can break down his turnovers and put them into a 10-minute video thing. And look, these are the passes you're trying that are not working. And what, you know, the old thing, don't throw it there. I mean, Lenny Wilkins had one of his pet peeves, and I saw that, is like, you don't try to throw the ball to somebody inside from the top of the key. There are too many hands in the way. He would have all these drills. In other words, even if it looks like the guy is sort of open and you want to get to someone inside, pass it to somebody on the wing. It's much easier to throw an inbounds pass or a pass to the post from the wing, because the angles are better than from up there. Because you just said that there's too much traffic. It creates a better line of vision. That was something that I have seen from Garland. He's sometimes forcing those passes. And I think there, once in a while, he's trying these lob passes that aren't there. And actually, his floater is there when he goes in. He could shoot it a little more. But my guess is it's not anything that's going to sink him. And the fact is, what, they won a couple games without Donovan handling the ball, and because he's been out. But I think there's probably one or two things he keeps doing over and over again that are creating him. And that's what you do. You just show, it's not to put him down, to say, look, this is why it's happening.
Yeah, it's habits and thinking. And, you know, there's a saying in hockey, Terry, make the easy play. If you have a guy open, instead of trying to force the puck up the ice through three sets of legs, to give it to the open guy and let him do it from a different angle. It's basically what you're talking about, making the easy play, come into the post from the other side. So just for some perspective, Terry. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and a lot of times, not just from Garland, but I've seen these other guys, they are enamored with trying to throw the ball into the corner for the corner three. So they're almost coming, they'll skip passes called across the court, but they're almost throwing it along the end line, and it's crowded there. And so those balls are getting tipped, or you end up throwing them too high for the guy to catch and shoot. Just because you want to take corner threes doesn't mean you force the ball in that direction. I just, like, once in a while I say, just because you're open for a corner three, but it's not your shot, you don't have to take it.
Yeah, and just for some perspective, Terry, the 4.8 turnovers this season, the first 4 years of his career for Darius Garland's average turnovers per game, 2.6, yeah. 3.0, 3.6, and 2.9 last season. Now he's up to 4.8. So I'm thinking we'll see some, what do they call it, regression to the mean as we go along and get more. He gets more comfortable and gets more games in here. But
I also know he was playing, wasn't it, with a hamstring or what was a groin pull or whatever it was early in the year, because the 3-point shooting has not been that good this season. When you look at it, and I believe he's at 32%, and so that's been a bit of a problem also. I mean, I really like Garland as a player. The biggest concern for me always with him is durability, because he is built slight and he is prone to just getting these different type of, what you call them, wear and tear injuries or soft tissue, take your pick.
All right. So speaking of guard play, Terry, Craig Porter Jr., I know you've been high on him from the beginning when the Cavs signed him to a two-way deal. 23 years old, and Donovan Mitchell gave him the game ball the other night after he scored 21 points, a career high, 7 of 10 from the field, 7 of 7 from the free throw line, 2 assists, 4 rebounds, 2 steals, and a block. He played 25 minutes and did all that.
Yeah.
It's important that he's doing this given the Cavs' depth at guard right now, right? You mentioned Donovan Mitchell injury situation. Ty Jerome has been out with an ankle sprain. Like, this has been a pleasant surprise and a big boost for this backcourt.
And when Jerome was playing in the preseason a little bit early in the season, I was really underwhelmed. I know they were high on him. I didn't have much of an opinion on one way or the other when they signed him. But Porter has the ability. He's an old-fashioned guard. I remember Wayne Embry would say he's not a point guard. He's not a shooting guard. He's a guard. He could defend from that position. He could rebound. Like you said, he had 7 field goals, 7 free throws, 21 points. Now, it'd be nice if he could make some three-pointers, but that's not his game. So don't make it be your game. Make it be your game, which is a lot of penetration, going to the rim, setting up your teammates, drawing fouls. You know, this is a guy that when he was at Wichita State with his team in rebounding and block shots and assists, I think he was second in scoring, you know, loose balls, all that. He plays like a guy who knows every night his job is on the line. He's strong physically. He's got, you know, they always say strong, you know, core muscles and all that. It's hard to bump him off the ball. And he fits the kind of stuff that I like, guys coming off the bench, because even if the shot's not falling, he's doing all this other stuff.
Yeah, and then you look at the end of the game, and especially when he was in college, Terry, and he's filled up the box score in like 5 different ways, and you're like, wow, how did he do that? So those 21 points, by the way, Terry, were the most points scored by an undrafted Cavs rookie since cult hero Matthew Dellavedova.
Wow.
That's an interesting tidbit. So there you go. All right, so the Cavs tonight, we're taping this on Tuesday afternoon, Terry. The Cavs are at Philly tonight as part of that in-season tournament. Then they're playing Wednesday here back at home against the Heat in the in-season tournament. And then they have the Lakers on Saturday at 7:30. And the Cavs game tonight against Philly is on TNT. How about that, Terry? The Cavs on national TV, a 51-win team from a year ago.
Yeah.
And every time you turn on the TV, it's the Celtics, Lakers, and 76ers playing almost every time. So the Cavs finally get some national exposure tonight. Hey, I haven't had a chance to ask you, do you like this in-season tournament or not? What do you think?
No, 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 nothing. I don't care. Who cares?
The players barely care.
The only people that care are whoever makes the money for drawing the stuff on the floor. That's it. Whoever gets to redesign that. No.
What if they made it where if you win this thing, you get at least an 8th seed in the playoffs? If there was something to play for.
Maybe. I guess my feeling is regular season games should be something anyway. I mean, it just should. And creating this, whatever this is, if you're on the winning team, you get $100,000. I mean, it's great if you're Craig Porter Jr. or somebody like that. But in a league where the average salary, by the way, the average salary is over $9 million. Did I say it was over $9 million? Because it's over $9 million. That would be like, okay, you and I, if we won this, we get like $200. I mean, it's nice. Okay. Yeah. But it isn't like, gee, I've got to go out because I've been just lollygagging. Remember that from the Bill Duran, the third. Well, you've been lollygagging. They're out there lollygagging. All you, but I'm going to just crank it up for this in-season tournament because I like the floor that they changed the colors. It's just, I mean, why not make shots count for 4 points? You want to make it real different? I mean, give me a break.
Yeah, put trampolines in like that slam ball game.
And yeah, that's
completely ginned it up. So
here's the other thing. Maybe nobody's allowed to play more than 20 minutes in these games and then see how you win.
Yeah. All right, we'll put it all on the drawing board and see. Let's make it worth something or make it worth nothing. I think you're right.
It's just worth nothing. And you know, they have all these kind of things of margin of victory matters and that. I just want the Cavs to play well. And that's what I've liked of late. They're getting back to defending better. They're not as fixated on the three-point shot. By the way, you know, Chris Fedor, is one of the best basketball writers in the country. He's one of the best basketball writers ever to come through this market, says a guy who considers himself, once upon a time, one of the best basketball writers ever to come through the market, being me. And you also think, and also Brian Windhorst came through here. Brian was kind of my protege. And Bert Grafe was a very good one. And I learned a lot from Bert about that. But I like how Chris has been highlighting what Matt Strus does. It's not just about three-pointers. And you look at who are the Cavs' top three rebounders? I got
Jared
it in front
Allen,
of
me. Evan Mobley, and I don't know who the third one is. Who's the third one?
Okay, Mobley's at 10.5. Allen's at 7. Max Strus is nearly at 6.
And he's number 3.
Number 3. And then Mitchell's 4.9. And Strus has really raised up his rebounding totals from when he was with Miami, because he sees the need of team rebounding. That was one of the things I was talking about when the Cavs played the Knicks. The Knicks are sending everybody to the boards. Remember, Josh Hart was getting like 7 rebounds a game, and that was not just the big guys. And you have to help your big men, and guys like Strus and Mitchell, LeVert, they can get some rebounds if they're told to do it. And I have seen that of late, more emphasis from JB on these other guys. And I think Strus is leading the way. I mean, did you see the dunk he had the other day? I mean, he was like
something,
like slamming on that. And you look at that, and he's another guy. Now, he's hit the jackpot in terms of, you know, contract, but he still plays like a kid out of DePaul who got cut and bounced around and cut here and there. And also, I mean, he is a great one to talk to young Porter, because it's, look, I was just like you, kid, just like you. In fact, you're farther along right now than I was. And there's money to be made here by developing an all-around game. And that's, I was so glad that the advertising the Cavs gave on him, which was, he's not just a three-point shooter and all that. He's got a game. By the way, George Yang has shown me a little more of like kind of shots off the move and that than I thought he had. I have a friend of mine, Bob Fick, who loves to he loves the Sixers and watches that. He kept telling me that they just didn't play him enough in Philadelphia, and a lot of times they just had him standing in the corner. And now he was shot 40% from the corner. That's fine. But Nian, a couple of the games he's helped defensively, covering some of the bigger men. So Kobe's two big acquisitions there have been very helpful. And then you turn around and look at Porter, picked up undrafted free agent. Wasn't it funny? It was all Amani Bates, Amani Bates, Amani Bates, and look who's playing.
Yep.
The guy who fills up the stat sheet. Because you got enough guys shooting, taking shots, especially when Mitchell is playing, that you don't – I mean, it's nice when Porter scores 21. You don't need that. But if he gets 8 to 10 off the bench in 20 minutes, he's getting 5 assists and 4 rebounds and 6 floor burns, that's what you want.
Yeah, the Cavs are bigger, they're better shooting, and they're tougher this year. I just think we need to cut – they're going to rip off like 6-8 in a row at some point here soon when they get everything going. But – hey, Terry, you mentioned Chris Fedor. I want to give a quick plug. Ethan Sands has joined Chris on the Cavs beat, and they have taken the Wine and Gold Talk podcast to 5 days a week, and they were joking. Fedor was joking about having Strus play all 48 minutes every night.
Well, I could see, you know, the temptation is there.
Definitely. But if his approach to the game every day, just grinding and we do it this way, if it rubs off on all the other guys, he can take his minutes down even more than they are now, because other guys will start to play like that and it'll seep into the rest of the roster. And pretty soon you got a really good thing going. So this is how starts, right?
One of the dangers, by the way, is for the guys from Miami that other teams are telling me, is you have to be careful when you get them, because they play so physical and play so hard and practice so hard. Sometimes they're worn down when you get them physically. So, and they'll come in and they want to play 48 minutes like it's the last game of their life. And so you have to watch that, because the temptation is what? I want that out there all the time. But that, to me, it's been exciting. You know, isn't it, David, to see that Strus, Niang, and Porter specifically, the new guys coming in. And then you turn around, and I think LeVert has played very well. Because remember, LeVert, I told you a couple of my friends were agents. They were just shocked that he came back for that deal in terms of it was a 2-year deal. And, you know, I know, well, $16 million, it sounds crazy, but the NBA is nuts. Remember, the average salary in the NBA is almost $10 million. It's $9+ some million. And so they have him, and he's willing to come off the bench. I'm just excited. By the way, it was a week ago that I got two emails saying, it really is time to get rid of JB.
We're not even out of November.
Yeah. You know, by the way, remember, like, I like Charlie Brown and Peanuts, and it's like somebody would say something like that, and then he would just write sigh, S-I-G-H. Like, this is just so stupid.
All right, Terry. Yes. Let's move on to the Guardians here. We're running a little behind here, so I want to keep us moving. So you wrote about the Cal Quantrill move the other day. We got an email from our longtime listener, Neil, in Jamestown, New York, and he says, hey, Terry, when Chris Antonetti quickly admits that Quantrill was moved for financial reasons, that can't be a good forecast for an offseason to come. Your thoughts? And you wrote about this, about how Antonetti said that they were expecting Quantrill to make about $6.5 million, I think, in arbitration next season, and that played into it. What's your take on how they handled that whole situation, and what's the offseason looking like?
Well, what it is, it was a trade of Quantrill for Barlow. That's what it was. And they made the decision that they tried to – do you see what was his name? Ronaldo Lopez. I believe he got $30 million over three. I forgot who he signed with. $10 million a year. I really liked him. They did too. But that's starting to be the going rate for these guys, $8 to $10 million for really good relievers who aren't even pure closers. So they felt that getting Barlow – I mean, also, I've been getting emails, you know, they traded De Los Santos for him, and Barlow overall had an ERA over four. If you look at Barlow, he got off to a bad start with the Royals last year. He got traded at midseason to San Diego. He had an ERA of about three. And if you look at his career of the last 2 years in 21 and 22, his ERA was like 2.3, pitching very well for the Royals. They've just felt that they needed to get another experienced arm back there to help Class A, because the burden of trying to save all those games on him was enormous. And Trevor Stephan, who they were counting on, he would melt in the eighth inning. And so that's what it was, valuing the relievers. And I will say this, I like Quantrill. I was a Quantrill fan. I still am. I wouldn't be surprised if he bounces back and pitches well. But analytics hates him. He won the lowest strikeout rates going, high contact. And generally, when the Guardians get rid of a pitcher, they're right. You can look at whether it's Clevinger Kluber, and I'm sure I'm forgetting a couple of others. I had a list of about four of them of recent vintage when they got rid of them or didn't re-sign them. The guys were pretty much done. So they not only are good at developing them, they're pretty good at knowing when the development is over. And they must have felt that about Quantrill. To me, they gave Mike Zunino $6 million. You know, I would have liked to have just see them keep Quantrill and find another way to get Barlow.
Yeah.
Because by the way, San Diego is cutting payroll like crazy. So that was a big move there. They knew he was going to make $6 or $7 million. They took De Los Santos for $1 million. So that trade could have been made without necessarily Quantrill, but the Guardians and several other teams are very worried on the Bellies contract. And I'm hearing from some readers saying, well, they will be able to get a lot of money because they go back in the free agent market for the cable contract. That whole landscape has changed because of streaming. David, do you know much about that? Because I don't.
Yeah, I was just going to talk about that for a second, just for some background. So basically, Bally's Sports Network, which airs the Cavs, the Guardians, their parent company is bankrupt. They've been haggling with teams all year, like, we're going to give you some of the money, we're not going to give you any of the money. And it's coming to the point where they're going to pull the plug potentially on the Guardians. Mm-hmm. And MLB might take over the broadcasting of the Guardians games next season. That's all to be determined. But as you mentioned, Terry, the Bally money being kind of hanging out there, yes or no, or how much are we going to get? The Guardians are going to have a hard time making their offseason budget because of it, because they don't know if that money's coming in. It's probably not. How much are they going to make from MLB? I think it's like 80% they get from MLB instead of the full 100%. So that all figures in, and it's just a mess. It's too bad.
It's funny. It looks like the two teams that they know for sure they're going to cut are the Guardians and the Rangers.
Yeah, go figure.
Yeah, now they said the Rangers' contract was basically double Cleveland's. They're like 110, Cleveland's like 53 or something, a million. So those are things to keep an eye on. But it definitely is a factor there on what they'll spend. So let's keep an eye. Let's see how Quantrill does with Colorado, which, by the way, is a horrible, horrible place for him to get traded to. A pitcher that pitches to contact in a ballpark where the ball flies all over the place. But if you're Colorado and you're desperate for pitchers and they want to give me Cal Quantrill for a Class A catcher, I'll take it.
Why not?
Why not? If it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
All right, Terry, real quick, I want to get into Stephen Vogt real quick. We podcasted a couple of Tuesdays ago, and then on Friday, Stephen Vogt had his introductory press conference down at Progressive Field. You were down there. Just real quick, highlights, things you'll remember, or things that impressed you or didn't impress you, either way.
Well, he does have kind of a knack of talking about the obvious in an interesting way. And he's a bit of a storyteller like Francona. So I could see from your meetings and all that with him, he's very engaging. You could tell why. I mean, he's talking about how he was headed out to the horse farm waiting for Chris Antonetti to call. And then he gets a job. He goes, well, I guess I got to go finish cleaning up the manure. And that's a Francona story. You know, Francona's like, I was sitting there, and next thing I know, I ate four hot dogs and I got indigestion and I'm thinking about the bullpen. I mean, it's like, it's just, and by the way, who gets hurt by this? Nobody. Meanwhile, people are laughing, and there's a humanity, a human element there. How he will do, I have no clue, because he hasn't done anything, really. Now, you could talk about, yes, catchers have a lot more to do, and they do now, because they are working with the analytics people and the scouts more than ever. But as I wrote a column, who do you want? You weren't getting Craig Counsell, so just get off of that. Counsell's doing Milwaukee, and he was playing for Chicago. He wanted to stay near home, and he wanted to get a bunch of money. And even had they matched that offer that he got from the Cubs, he was going to the Cubs because he's got two daughters in school in Whitefish Bay, which is just south of Milwaukee, and in high school. He did not want to leave, mess that up. So that wasn't going to happen. So then you're into, Mendoza, these other guys that got hired. I mean, I don't know. You can put them all in a bag, close your eyes, and pick one out. I don't know which one of these guys is going to be any good.
I did think it was interesting, Terry. You're talking about the analytics side and also kind of the gut side. And Tito did that so well, was just kind of working on both sides of that fence. But Stephen Vogt was talking about how, like, there's 150 to 175 decisions that you make in every game that can decide whether you win or lose. And he says a catcher is in the middle of all of that. And he also said, like, he loved, one of the things he prided himself on, he loved to chat up guys when they came into bat. And, like, he says, I was really good at that. And if I could distract you from paying attention to the pitcher, even a little bit, like, that was what I was going to do. So I thought that was just kind of a little symbolic tip to, like, both sides of the analytics and the baseball gut thing, that he seems like he's into both of it. And I thought that was a good sign for the Guardians.
Francona was very good at distracting you when things were going hard with some story about something, or making one of his players seem very human, who's struggling, whatever it may be. And that, it makes the players feel like the guy has their back. But now and then Tito will say, look, I don't know what Kwan was doing on that play once. I remember early in spring training, he goes, he just overthrew the cutoff man. He knows we can't overthrow the cutoff man. But he came out of the game. He's in the dugout. He just looks at me. He goes, before I say anything, Steve said, I know. So see how he did that. He turned around and acknowledged it was a poor play on Kwan's part, missing the cutoff man. Then he turned around and turned it into a positive for Kwan, because Kwan said, "Oh yeah, I know, Tito, I know." And then he goes, "I didn't even have to follow it up from there." So that's the kind of stuff that is important, because that's leadership there. But you know, the big deal will be, man, you know, how many pitches do I let this guy go? I'm so glad they're going to have Carl Willis is back. You're going to have Sandy back. I keep waiting to see. They're supposed to make a big, you know, kind of third base coach hire or something like that coming up, to see who that's going to be. And I'm all for it, but man, there's only one Tito. And I know, here come the emails. Yeah, but how many World Series did he win here? Okay. And how many times do they go to the playoffs here? And how many times do they have teams worth watching here? And all that type of thing. I hope they have the right guy. I would not have wanted to be hiring a manager this year, David. I really wouldn't have.
Well, we can say a lot of things, and I'm sure there's a lot of opinions, but one thing we can say is that the Guardians didn't do their due diligence. I think they said, what was it, 55 hours of Zoom interviews, and it just, he said he met everybody in the organization, and they put those guys through the ringer to make sure they didn't miss anything. And
yeah,
so that's a good sign.
Yeah, you just don't know. I remember Francona was telling me about Mickey Callaway early on, who Callaway had ended up having his problems off the field, and then things really degenerated when he went with the Mets. But Callaway was a good pitching coach here. And they brought Callaway up to be Tito's pitching coach. And Callaway, he said, you know, that's one of the things, he goes, a manager puts a lot of pressure on a pitching coach. You know, how you want to handle the bullpen, this and that, he said. And Callaway, he said, he knew when he needed to stand up to me. He says, and Carl Willis, he had that, because he had Willis before, and then Willis came back here after Callaway left. He said, that's when you have a guy. So that's what we'll have to see when Steven Vogt, when it comes time for him to stand up to the front office or stand up to a player, how does he do it? Now, I was told, because I said, just because he's quote-unquote a great teammate and everybody likes him, that doesn't necessarily mean he's a good manager. And I was told by a couple of people, no, they really checked it out, that he was a guy who would challenge you know, teammates, much like Napoli did and much like Jason Giambi did. In the clubhouse. And they must, the Guardians, I think, lost sight of this the last few years. They must go get a couple veterans like Giambi and like
Napoli.
Whether it was Napoli or even, I was told, like last year, Luke Maley was a big help along, and Austin Hedges. They lost something like that. Jose and Ahmed Rosario were very good with Latino players, but they needed some of the overall thing that they just didn't have. And I mean, that was Vogt did that himself. They better go get some guys like that, because your rookie manager is going to need some help.
All right. Well, the Guardians are going to be opening the season, oddly enough, in Oakland, which is where Steven Vogt has a huge fan base, and it's going to be an emotional series for him. And it was funny. He said, yeah, hopefully we'll start with a win. And he said, I mean, three wins.
Yeah.
He corrected himself real fast. So, all right, Terry, we got to move along here. We do have a couple more letters we want to get to for our 100th episode. A while back, you asked fans to write and where they're from and why they are a Cleveland sports fan. So we got a couple here to wrap up today's podcast. This first one is from Brian Kirkendall. And he says, hey, guys, you wanted stories about being a Cleveland fan. I was born in Mansfield, and I live in Minneapolis. Now, my dad loved Woody Hayes and was a Steelers fan. I took on being a diehard Buckeyes fan, but my love was Greg Pruitt and Brian Sipe.
Mm.
What I think really cemented my Browns fandom was my uncle got me a subscription to the Browns News Illustrated for Christmas, and I read every word. When the Browns moved, I was a student at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. I put all my Brown stuff in a box and sent it to the league office and told them where they could put it.
I was so hurt.
Yeah, no kidding. When they came back, I was lukewarm about it. Then me and my wife, who is from Pittsburgh, went to see the Brownies and Steelers in Pittsburgh, and those darn orange helmets pulled me back in. I always rooted for the Indians and somewhat the Cavs, but never that fiercely. Football to me, it's the Buckeyes and Browns, and always will be. So, thanks for that, Brian. Brian Kirkendall.
How about that combination of Woody Hayes and the Steelers, but he gravitates to Cleveland?
Yeah, yeah, go figure, yeah. Right? And the dad, yeah. The dad was a big Woody Hayes fan. So, all right, and here's our last one, Terry. This one's a little bit longer. It's from Dennis Kotnik, and he is from Slovenia.
Okay.
He says, hello, I heard on the Terry Pluto podcast an invitation for long-distance Cleveland fans. Well, my story is strange and long. In the second half of the 1980s, I was growing up in the former Yugoslavia. Now it is Slovenia. There we had quite a decent life. We could travel to Western Europe. Working families had cars and owned houses, skiing and seaside vacations. On the other side, no political parties were allowed. It was hard to grow private business. Shops had just two or three kinds of each item, not 50 as it is now. We had Western music and movies on radio and movies and TV. There was not that many programs. I was often studying in my room and some day started searching stations on the FM radio, and there I found some sports reporter passionately describing some game. I recognized that it was American football, and the radio station was the Armed Forces Radio, which was having full games. In neighboring Italy, there's still an American base. It's about 150 miles away from my home. In the following weeks, more games followed, and I learned the rules just by listening to the radio. Then I discovered the team names, the teams and names. Somehow the Cleveland Browns were most interesting to me. They say Cleveland has one of the largest populations of Slovenians in the world. I've never been there and have no relatives, but I like the surname of a certain QB named Kozar. It sounded Slavic to me. And he said today there's about 150 people in Slovenia with the surname Kozar. And he says, I chose the NFC team. The Packers were my NFC team, but they were not very good at the time. The Armed Forces Radio followed all the pro sports, including the NBA. And then Cleveland had a team and quite a good one, the Cavs. I remember Price, Doherty, Harper. Around the year 1988, the Slovenian-Italian TV program showed sports all day, and we could watch NBA and NFL games. I remember not single games, but names. Matthews and Slaughter, Michael Jackson, Leroy Horde, Metcalf, and Vinny Testaverde. In the mid-90s, the Indians got very good, and of course I followed some of their playoff games. Then they got this great coach, Francona. I often watched day highlights and play-by-play of the regular season games. Again, they were so close with the Cubs in the World Series, so many hurt pitchers and lost in Game 7. Somehow, I am a long-distance Cleveland sports fan. I read Cleveland.com and Terry Pluto and other reporters. I'm probably more a fan of the Cavs and Guardians than the Browns. But there is something strange with Cleveland sports. They often come so close but can never get to that trophy. Maybe someday I will visit Cleveland in person and go to these stadiums I know only from TV and radio. And he says, kind regards, this is Dennis Kotnik from Slovenia. So there we go, Terry. Pluto Nation extends to Slovenia.
Well, no one will ever accuse him of being a front runner when he adopted the team.
Yeah, no kidding.
And,
right.
Well, I am of Slovak descent. So, and I believe Kozar is Slovak, because I think Bernie and I had that. Of course, Slovak and Slovakia, Slovenia, they're, you know, all those little countries there. So, and he is correct in terms of the Slavic base in our town is still real strong. So, hey, well, I'll take a reader anywhere he is. I'll take him all over the globe.
Well, that's one of the great things about Cleveland, too, is there's so many neighborhoods with so many people from different parts of the world, and that's what makes this a fun place to live. So, all right, Terry, we got to wrap it up here, but it is Thanksgiving week, and I you always write a lovely Thanksgiving column each week, and maybe we want to talk about Thanksgiving real quick here.
Because one of the things that I've known for almost ever is if you don't have any readers, they don't need any writers. And that the one I always write, without you, the readers, there's no need for us. And now, more than ever, readers can go read or listen however they want to take their content, but they don't have to listen to any of us. And a lot of you still, obviously, you listen to this or whatever, you're the hardcore and the base, and we appreciate you. And you know, whether it's my books or just different things, and I'm just thrilled to be able to do this long in the market where I grew up. And so this is, I'm just grateful. And I really mean that, you know, at my stage of my career and that I could still keep going and people still care about what I have to say. And I think that like venues like the podcast allows all of us to get to know each other better, whether it's the longer emails you send in or the stories that we tell here.
Yeah, Terry, thanks. I want to echo that. Thank you for everybody who listens. And I wanted to say I'm thankful I get to do this with you every week. I think we've had a really fun run here, and I've learned a lot about you, and it's been a great time. So thank you. I'm thankful that we've been able to do this.
Well, you're the boss, so I got to thank you too. No, that
all right.
it is fun because I do think we had a discussion of how we're going to do this, and it's not going to be profanity. It's not going to be have a hot take just to have a hot take. I was talking to somebody who was recently at ESPN, and it said it drove him nuts. They would go in and just they want you. Well, come in strong, have a strong opinion. And a lot of times, like with Stephen Vogt, I don't have a strong opinion. I don't know what he's going to do. We talked about different aspects of it. I don't know. And if you say that at ESPN, you'll get fired. Say he's going to be great. Say he's going to be terrible. Say something.
All right. Well, this will wrap it up for this edition. Terry, anything you want to get into? We done?
No, other than one last plug, terrypolitobook.com. The guy with the sign is, I signed like 300 and some of these books. They're sitting there. Now they're starting to move out of the place now, but a lot of them are still lonely, looking for a home.
All right. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving, Terry. Everybody out there, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. If you're traveling, be safe. And we will catch you next week on Terry's Talking.